Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Renowned graphic designer, pop culture anthropologist, and executive editor for publishing house Tash in America, Jim Hyman is also an avid menu collector. His collection provided some of the hundreds of images in the beautiful book, Menu Design in America. Jim illustrates for us what we learn from menus about American history and culture. Then, we explore food history and culture with documentarian Peggy Scott Laborde. She's here to talk about her latest work, Nostalgic New Orleans Eats and Drinks. And if you're venturing out to the Poor Boy Festival this weekend, you'll be fascinated by Michael Mazel Nelson's examination of the many ties between our historic streetcars and the iconic Poor Boy sandwich. We're serving up some delicious history along with a side of fun on this week's Louisiana Eats. Longtime graphic designer, pop culture anthropologist, and executive editor for publishing house Tash in America, Jim Hyman provided the editing hand on the Toshin book, Menu Design in America. Jim, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thanks so much, Poppy.
First of all, for the uninitiated, would you tell us about Toshin?
Toshin is a German publishing house. It's run by one guy named Benek Toshin. And we produce books that range from $9.99 to $10,000. We do some pretty spectacular books, primarily on art, architecture, photography, very highly collectible books, and then, like I said, also some affordable books.
So how did the menu book come about?
You know, the menu book is the result of my own personal collection of menus. It's probably, at this point, somewhere around 30 years that I started collecting these. Then that came from several books that I did prior to my work with Toshin. And I did a book on the history of the drive-in restaurant. And being a graphic designer, the graphics on these menus were pretty spectacular in some instances. So I started collecting these more for kind of research purposes, but then gradually the aesthetic of the menu cover really grabbed me. I just started going for it. And then it became kind of a critical mass. And this is one that he felt was definitely worthy of the large format that we put it into, because there's so much interesting stuff in these menus in relationship to the history of eating in America.
It really is a massive book. It measures 10 by 12 and 3/4 inches, and I think it weighs at least 3 pounds. Yes. How many images are in the book?
You know, there's close to around, I believe, 500 or so images. And so that was a huge editing job to take all of these images from 5,000 and reduce to this format. But in doing so, it really forced me to edit out stuff that didn't really follow a narrative. And the narrative that I was really trying to show, again, was how America eats, and also show the graphic chronology of these menus.
So it's, in essence, a history of restaurants and dining out in America.
Absolutely. Yep.
So tell us what you learned. Tell us about some of the trends that you saw come and go. What do we learn in this book?
Early on in the history of America, restaurants weren't really a pervasive element in dining at all. Most people ate at home, and hotels provided meals. And so that's probably the first instance where the public really is introduced to dining, is through hotels and traveling. Now, as America grew and restaurants became part of an urban environment, then you start seeing more and more restaurants. Now, in terms of food-wise, French cuisine seemed to dominate most of the menus. There are some regional aspects to a lot of restaurants that you might find fresh game in Colorado, or in San Francisco you might have seafood or Dungeness crab, things that are really local delicacies. So you would see these appear in these menus. So it really was telling in terms of, you know, what was available locally, but also the French cuisine was something that was so prevalent and was associated with fine dining that it really dominated. Then you roll into the advent of the car, so all of a sudden you're dining in your car with drive-ins and inexpensive food. The precursor to fast food makes its appearance, so hamburgers and hot dogs. We have rationing during World War II, which forces Americans to reconsider vegetables and other things that aren't meat-oriented. And then we get into the fast food era of the 50s, where things take on very kind of quick pace with coffee shops. The drive-in restaurant is still prevalent, but it starts its descendancy. And then you start having much more interesting cuisine in terms of the sophistication of the American palate.
Something else that seemed to be drastically clear to me is that when it comes to food, apparently sex really sells. And some of the nudity you see on these menus, and it's in every decade, I think would shock a lot of people today. Talk to us about some of those nudes on the menus.
Yeah, that was one aspect of the graphics that I found really interesting, because some of the subject matter that you find on some of these menus, there's some very, very provocative and salacious material on front, most of it having to do with women and nudity. So you have lots of bare-breasted women, lots of suggestive poses. Actually, one menu, which I thought was quite interesting, was for a men's club in San Francisco in the early part of the 20th century. And there's two satyrs that are dragging a nude woman, and she's tied up. And what that had to do with the meal, I'm not quite sure. I never expected to find that on a menu.
Well, Jim, those satyrs were wearing chef's hats.
Oh, well, there you go. So there's all kinds of instances of these really great pinup type women. But again, the suggestion of the nudity and so on is really, like you mentioned, follows all of the decades, so that sex did play a good part in the serving of food throughout the 20th century.
Well, on the topic of things that I think people would find shocking, I think really to people today, as shocking as the nudes might be, also some of the blatant racism issues. I mean, for instance, even the name Pickaninny Barbecue is offensive. Talk to me about some of those just very politically incorrect things you find on those menus. And were they strictly from the South?
Oh, no. You found especially depictions of blacks really followed what was kind of cultural thing that was going at the time. I mean, the subjugation of certain racial stereotypes fell in tandem with what was going on in most of cultural references at the time. The exaggeration of facial features was very prevalent. So blacks were depicted as a very cartoon-like manner. You know, it's so offensive was a place called the Coon Chicken Inn. And not only did all of their graphics depict a bellhop black cartoon character, the actual reference was in the shape of a giant head of this cartoon bellhop. And he would walk in through the mouth of the character, and that served as the entrance to the restaurant. So there's those instances, but it's not only limited to blacks. You know, Chinese were also the object of some of this racial stereotyping. There's a restaurant in Honolulu that the entire menu is done in pidgin English.
Oh, no. What was the wording?
Oh, it's meat Nike. The owner was Chinese, and so he used this kind of language that is so stereotypical of Chinese. He made it a point that he emphasized that as a selling point to come to the restaurant. So the entire menu, including the items, is all done in pidgin English through Chinese filter.
Well, and so then in that post-World War II period, there's a whole lot of the yellow peril sort of imagery, too. Huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's racial depictions of Chinese being yellow and mysterious. And again, this was what the cultural norms were at the time. And so people kind of went along with this depiction. And then it pretty much evaporates, although there are still some of those images appearing into the 60s and so on. But by the 70s, that's no longer acceptable. There wasn't necessarily just one particular segment of the population that was singled out for stereotyping. It went across the board.
In researching menus, do you know how the menu itself began?
Yeah, it's, again, follows the industrialization of the printing process so that initially most restaurants didn't have a printed menu. The menu was really on a blackboard. Originally, someone would just come and tell you what items there were. And in most cases, there weren't a lot of items. So it was easy to memorize 6 or 7 entrees and so on. And then when it became a little bit more complex, then you would put them on a board. And then once the printing process became affordable in the late 1800s, then you started seeing people having printed menus. But again, most of it was in hotel restaurants where you would find the printed menu or for special occasions. So if there was a reunion of Civil War soldiers, you would find these menus printed, and they became very, very elaborate towards the end of the 19th century with ribbons and die cuts and shapes. And for these special occasions, sometimes they would pull all the plugs out and do something really, really expensive. And they're really beautiful examples of the printer's art.
Jim, by your estimate, what's the state of the menu today? Is there anybody out there creating really remarkable menus?
Well, I'll tell you, I actually, as part of my graphic design career, I still design menus for restaurants here in L.A. So I'm just in the process of doing one right now. What has really taken over the menus is the computer.
Yeah.
But there are some restaurants, some fine dining restaurants, that really don't want to have that look. They still are willing to spend some money and get a really nice job on that. You know, people are talking about stuff on your iPhone, that when you go to a restaurant, you just go to a certain thing and you don't even have to talk to a waitress. You just decide what your items are and send it to the kitchen. So those things are slowly evolving in the restaurant world in terms of menu. But it depends on the owners. It's evolving. There's still some people who are, you know, like the idea of a printed menu to complement their restaurant if they feel that it's very unique. And then there's other people who are interested in just the information and not necessarily something specialized, but a little bit more generic.
Well, I just was fascinated with the whole topic. Love, love, love the book. And I hope all the Louisiana Eats listeners have a chance to thumb through some Tashin books sometime in the future.
Yeah, I hope so too.
Jim Hyman, executive editor of Tashin Books. Louisiana Eats rambling reporter Ian McNulty always knows just where to stop for something delicious as he travels the highways and byways of Louisiana. Ian, welcome back, and tell me where you've been rambling lately.
Hey, Poppy, I'm glad to be back with you, of course. One of my latest trips was to the little town of Henderson, Louisiana, of course, which is right on the edge of the Atchafalaya Basin. And, you know, one of the reasons I love this town, Henderson, is that in the popular imagination of what Louisiana is outside of the cities, you know, specifically what Cajun country is, sometimes people tend to think about, oh, these little waterfront shacks where they make this great gumbo or something, but it's like so far off the beaten path, only the locals know about it. At the very least, your onboard navigation is never going to get you to this little pier or this little dock where you're going to find this just central casting Louisiana scene. Well, Henderson has that, and it's right off of Interstate 10. I mean, it's right off the highway. If you've thundered down I-10, you know, on the way to Houston or something, you've definitely passed by the exit for Henderson.
Yeah. Is it between Baton Rouge and Lafayette?
Yeah, exactly. It's actually pretty close to Lafayette. It's maybe 20 minutes just to the east of Lafayette. But you take that turn off of there, you go through the little town. The little town is just a small little kind of country town, but then you get to the waterfront. And the waterfront is a scene that will be familiar to anyone in New Orleans because it's just a big, fat, green levee, this big levee running along the Atchafalaya Basin, holding all that stuff in. But also, if in New Orleans you've ever taken a peek over the levee and seen all this stuff on the other side and just had this curtain-raising revelation kind of moment, that's what happens in Henderson when you point your car up over the levee. You drive up these little dirt roads, and you come up over the top, you see spread before you the splendor that is the Atchafalaya Basin. Beautiful water, cypress trees, animals everywhere, you know, birds flapping around. It's just a great welcome to wilderness kind of scene.
And some of the best crawfish in the universe growing in there.
That's your basin crawfish. And so perched along these levees, too, on the wet side of the levee, on the batcher side of the levee, as we call it here in river country, is these landings. They're these businesses that have evolved through, you know, just Cajun enterprise. They might start as a boat launch or a bait shop or something, but they've grown into these, like, complexes. Now, there's a few of them. Probably my favorite for a good stop off the road, the one I'm going to recommend today, is McGee's Landing.
Okay, Ian, I'm hungry. So what do I order once I get there?
Right. Well, they have a very traditional Louisiana menu. So you're talking about, of course, you got etouffees and gumbos, also broiled steaks, of course, lots of fried seafood. Some really interesting things there. They'll have, like, what they call camp-style etouffee. That'll be a blend of crab and shrimp. It's sort of like a kitchen sink etouffee, mm-hmm. You know. It's
like you didn't have enough of either, so right. You put them together.
Everything they caught, yeah.
Yum.
Food's really good. The setting is, frankly, the star of the show. I mean, you're dining on the other side of the levee here. You have an unimpeded view of that Atchafalaya Basin. It's gorgeous. You know, people are having a good time everywhere. They're launching boats. They're coming in with stories. You know, they run a little swamp tour out of here. People take the airboats out. And like I said, there's little houseboats that people can camp out in overnight, just right there tied to the dock. It's a really cool setting. And all up and down the levee in Henderson, it's like this. But just down the levee, there's Angel's Whiskey River Landing, which is
that's quite a name.
Yeah, that's not actually a restaurant. That's a bar. But they have great, typically Zydeco and Cajun shows there on Sundays. But there's a lot going on in this town. And then, of course, there's Turtle's Bar, which is, again, attached to another one of these landings. It's just really fun. You know, everybody comes back from a day of boating on the weekend. They just party there for a while and swap fishing stories. But for a place where you want to roll in, you can have a nice family meal here. You can sit out on the porch, open air, look out over the whole Atchafalaya Basin is McGee's Landing. Can't recommend it enough.
Oh, Ian, thank you so much for taking us to another great Louisiana spot. Thanks. Come back soon.
Absolutely. I'll be back.
Ian McNulty, Louisiana Eats, rambling reporter. When we come back from a short break, Peggy Scott Labor joins us to talk about what she learned while making her latest documentary, Nostalgic New Orleans Eats and Drinks. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Dr. Gourmet, internist Tim Harlan, is known for combining good medical sense with delicious eating. Here to talk about one of man's most basic and important seasonings, Dr. Gourmet. Tim, welcome back to Louisiana Eats.
It is great to be here, Poppy.
Let's talk salt sense. The human body actually needs some salt to function properly. Isn't that correct?
That is correct. So sodium chloride, which is salt, so one molecule of sodium, one molecule of chloride put together, comes out in that nice white little crystalline substance that we like to put on our food. We do need both of those minerals, actually.
So what does that do for our body? What do we need it for?
Well, you need it for almost everything. It basically helps maintain the body's equilibrium, if you will. It's one of the major minerals in the body or solutes that keeps the rest of the liquid from being too thin or too thick. Might be a good way to think about it. But at the same time, sodium is also one of the major transmitters in the body and moving fluid across different membranes, etc. So there's just a host of different reasons we've got to have sodium to survive. Our bloodstream is about the same degree of saltiness as seawater.
When does salt become dangerous for humans?
I think the challenge with salt and the challenge with sodium is we eat too much of it. Right now, the average American eats about 6,000 milligrams of sodium a day, so that's about 2.5 teaspoons. And actually, some people eat well into the 10,000 milligrams, so call it 4 teaspoons of salt per day. You know, salt has been traditionally a preservative and a great preservative, you know, for pickled goods, for fermented goods, fermented foods, et cetera. So we tend to like salt and we tend to like salty foods because those we need that sodium, and it's sort of like sugar. When we taste it, it sends little signals to our brain that says, well, this is salty. I need some of this salt. And so we're a little more apt to eat it as a result of that.
Now, I don't think anybody's actually sitting down with 2.5 teaspoons of salt. So how are they consuming that?
Well, the majority of the sodium and the majority of the salt that we consume in America is in junk food. Potato chips, crackers, cookies, cakes, pies, a lot of things that you would think of that are really sweet. Bread has a lot of sodium in it, actually, cheeses, but mostly processed junk foods, fast foods, things that are on the shelf like, you know, canned beef stews, canned soups, those sorts of things. It's traditionally, again, been used as a preservative, and food processors like to use sodium for a number of different reasons. Number one, it does help preserve the food. But the other thing is we are more and more and more used to eating that sodium, so that people require higher triggers over the course of the last 40 years. A lot more salt in the foods today than there were 40 and 50 years ago.
Well, I know they don't call you Dr. Gourmet by accident. You really know your way around the kitchen. Do you have any food chemistry tips, any substitutions up your sleeve that will people who are on no salt diets that might make things more palatable for them?
I think, again, the challenge for folks who, and there are some of our patients and probably a lot of your listeners, we might want on, say, a 1,500 milligram a day salt diet because they have really severe hypertension. And we know that can make a huge difference in helping control as well as prevent high blood pressure, but also those folks with congestive heart failure and heart problems. There's a few things. Number one, fresh, fresh, fresh. Make it fresh. So if you're adding in fresh oregano, fresh thyme, fresh chives, you get that incredible fresh herb hit. You know, spices, if you're going to use great Cajun spices, you actually need less sodium because you've got so many other fantastic flavors. The second trick I would say is umami foods. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's the fifth taste bud. You know, you have salt, sweet, sour, bitter, and umami, which is savory, like mushrooms and Parmesan cheese and meat. Umami flavors need less salt. Then the third piece, and I'll say this again, I'll repeat it, measure the amount of sodium you're putting in because you need some salt in your food to help it taste great. We've done a lot of taste tests in the Dr. Gourmet kitchen, and I don't have, this is not science, but one of the things that I strive for my low sodium dishes is that it has at least about 300 milligrams or 350 milligrams of sodium. It seems that 300 milligram is the break point for a serving. So if you're going to say have some stew or red beans and rice, you need about 300 milligrams of sodium to activate the salt sensors on the taste bud. And you need that, you know, otherwise the food is bland. And I don't want you eating bland food. I want you eating great food that just happens to be great for you.
Okay, here is my last question. All of us who love food and food ingredients, there are so many salt choices now. You know, there's the gray pond salt. There's the pink salt from Hawaii. There's iodized salt. There's table salt. There's kosher salt. Is one salt better for you in any way than another?
No. Okay. So I know there's a lot of people out there, people who sell these salts, who would like you to believe that. But sodium chloride is salt. Salt is salt is salt is salt. It's not any lower sodium content. It's not any better for you. Now, it does taste differently. So, you know, the gray salts and the pink salts that may have been, you know, some of those pink salts from the bays in Japan where they evaporate and they get the beautiful salt, that's got other minerals, other flavors wrapped up in it that are not just the salty flavors, but they're not any better for you. They're a lot more expensive.
Well, Tim, why does it say on the package that kosher salt has less sodium?
Well, it doesn't really have less sodium. The crystals are bigger. And so if you have larger crystals, there's going to be more air pockets in between. So when you measure out a teaspoon, it'll have a little less actual sodium content than the finely ground stuff that comes in the round box with the little girl and the umbrella on it. It's the same amount of sodium by weight, but not the same amount of sodium by measure.
I just want to say thank you so much for this very interesting conversation about something so simple as salt.
It is always a joy to be with you.
Please come back with more good sense eating for us, will you?
Absolutely.
Dr. Gourmet, Tim Harlan. When he's not caring for patients, you can often find Dr. Gourmet in the kitchen dreaming up delicious new ways to apply his Mediterranean diet philosophy. Here's Tim's twist on everyone's favorite, fettuccine Alfredo. First, Tim makes a blonde roux using olive oil instead of butter. He whisks in 2% milk and a little goat cheese or light cream cheese, along with grated Parmigiano Reggiano and garlic. Healthier whole wheat fettuccine noodles are substituted for white. When you add 1.5 cups of steamed broccoli and 1/4 pound of peeled shrimp to the suggested 4 ounces of pasta per person, you've got quite a satisfying meal with only 539 calories. Learn more about Dr. Gourmet by visiting our Louisiana Eats website, where you'll also find the complete recipe for Tim's Fettuccine Alfredo. I'm Poppy Tooker, and this is Louisiana Eats. Documentarian Peggy Scott Laborde is back at it again. For over 25 years, Peggy has recorded the collective cultural memories of New Orleans, preserving them for posterity in her WYES documentaries. A favorite topic, of course, is food. On November 14th, her latest, Nostalgic New Orleans Eats and Drinks, premieres. Peg, welcome back to Louisiana Eats, and congratulations on the new work.
Thank you so much, Poppy, and I've been seeing sort of an extra a lot of you because you're in the documentary.
Okay, well, nepotism, there you go.
No. But we have a lot of great people. I think folks that you would expect, because I think you would expect to see, hopefully, Poppy and Tom Fitzmaurice, but we also have some surprises, too.
Well, you have covered all sorts of subject matter in your previous documentaries, but time and time again, you return to food. Now, why is that such a favorite topic?
Well, it's because, as you well know, when folks are getting together and having a meal, invariably, it does sound like a cliche, but it's not a cliche. It's true. We're usually talking about a meal we had recently at a local restaurant, especially these days. There's so many new restaurants opening up. It's hard to keep up. But a lot of us have a lot of these collective memories. And even when it comes down to the packaging of something, like for instance, we'll be talking about Dickie's potato chips. Some of you may remember that, some of you may not. But for some reason, that amber cellophane wrapping with the red and blue logo, some folks still talk about that kind of thing. Mackenzie's, of course. That's in the more recent past. And thanks to some folks at Tasty Donuts, we can still enjoy the buttermilk drops and
The turtles.
Of course, the turtles. But what I think is fun about this show, and I hope other people will feel this way too, is that we talk about some stuff that, to quote Benny Grunch, ain't there no more, but also the early history of some things that are still with us, like Popeyes, which 40 years of Popeyes. So we talk about the early history with Al Copeland Jr. Who else would know?
You actually interviewed Al Copeland Jr.?
Yes, and he, being a busy guy, that was a tough interview to get, even though invariably when he sat down, it was terrific. But he's out and about all the time, so we got him to sit down and to talk to. He was terrific, and he shared a lot.
How old was Al when his daddy started this business?
He was around, I'm thinking about the pictures that I saw, between 8 and 10 years old. But he ended up, and in just a little bit of a sneak preview, he and his siblings ended up really being sort of like the guinea pigs of some of this. Because Al would be tasting things and testing things at home initially. But he gives credit, and this is something I didn't know. He gives credit to his maternal grandparents, that his mom, Mrs. Al Copeland,
the first,
okay, yes, had roots in Houma. And he says that the dirty rice today, that certainly came by that side of the family who loved to cook and was really into it. Here it is 40 years later. It's something that we grew up with, Poppy, and we're used to. But people outside New Orleans were certainly not. We also talked to John Kerner, who was the former owner of one of the Barks franchises, and his family's been in the baking supply business forever. And he talks about that. This whole thing about the palate has changed because of Al Copeland in America, really, and beyond America.
They're all over the world. So there were some other juniors besides Al Copeland Jr. that you came across, I understand. And you spoke to Gerald Entringer Jr., whose family, of course, was the McKenzie's Bakery folks. So tell me some of his memories. What did he have to say?
Well, what happened with that, though, I think a lot of people will be curious to find out. So why is it called McKenzie's?
Okay, you know? True, with a name like Entringer.
Yes, okay. Well, the original Entringer moved to the Gulf Coast, and he was going to make cheese there. And there were one too many cheesemakers, so he decided to go into the bakery business. He opened up a shop there, and he hired this baker named McKenzie. Eventually, though, he decided to move on to New Orleans, and McKenzie decided to go into business for himself. And so McKenzie goes to New Orleans first and opens up at McKenzie's, kind of gets tired of being in business, sells the business to Entringer, and continues to work for him. But the name had been established, and it was a well-respected name, pretty successful, but I guess he just didn't want to be in the biz. And so that's why.
Well, it was such a huge business. How many McKenzie's were there?
There were almost 50 at one point.
My goodness.
And what still exists today, and this is part of the New Orleans trivia, is that they also had a fried chicken outlet, which is still around today in Gentilly.
So what's the name of that?
Of the chicken in a box.
Chicken in a box. Okay. Well, I know that there are two categories that you cover extensively in the documentary. And to me, these two categories clearly illustrate what we've been seriously missing here in New Orleans in modern times: dairies and then breweries. And
yes.
Were there parallels? And what did you learn about this?
Well, first of all, the proliferation of the dairies. We focus on Gold Seal, the Santani family, of course. But there were a lot of dairies on the West Bank. I mean, many of us remember going for ice cream at Borden's on Airline. But Gold Seal was in Mid-City, and as a matter of fact, their last fairly modern building, I say fairly because it was built in the 1950s, but for them it was very modern, on South Alexander Street, that's now lofts. It's been converted into apartments. We talk about that. The breweries, Falstaff Brewery in our apartments, so this sort of adaptive, you know, reuse, if you will. But yes, the whole brewery history of New Orleans is fascinating. And what's really fun is we really go into it. We talk to folks who I guess have quite the palate when it comes to beer, about which beers went better with peanuts or seafood. We talk about those seafood trays, which many of us still have hanging around. So parallels, well, I think a lot of the breweries tended to be owned with folks with more German roots, you know.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, some of the dairies, too. But also
That's true.
Was a kind of a mix, more of different cultures and ancestries. And, of course, with Santani, they were from Italy.
Well, of course, we would have to acknowledge that with the craft brewing movement, everything old is new again. So we've got breweries back in the city again. Any thoughts about old things you're seeing new again?
you can attribute to this because you are sort of, you are, of course, part of the story as you're talking about cream cheese. You know, cream cheese almost died out. Okay. And so to have Dornax and Motes and others, you know, involved.
Even John Foles.
John Foles. Yes, John Foles, too. The fact that you can go and get that fairly easily is really quite a miracle. Now, one thing, we interviewed Peter Mayer, as in Peter Mayer Advertising, and he told me, and I don't know if that this necessarily got in, most people would add sugar to their Creole cream cheese. I love that we're talking about this. Okay. He actually would be more savory.
Yes.
So it wasn't always a sweet thing. It could be more in the savory flavor.
Well, I heard that was the way the Germans like to
eat
it.
He is of German background.
So that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I know that you collect this memorabilia and that you go searching for it. What are some of the surprising visuals and the rare things we're going to see?
Well, Jack's is a great example. Jackson Brewery Company we're talking about spent a lot of money on stuff, okay? And what happened is at these local bars, you wanted the owners of the bars, you know, to sell your beer. So it's like, hi, have a clock. Hi, have, you know, a table tent menus, how, you know, all this memorabilia. And so fortunately, we have been able to locate some of that, and we have Mr. Ed Piglia, who has quite a collection, and he's in the show because he has a lot of good memories, too. But he shared with us some different things of his collection. So when you see, we're talking about Falstaff and Regal, you see the real thing.
Tell me, how can listeners outside of the viewing area see nostalgic New Orleans Eats and Drinks?
They can eventually, because we would offer it as a membership premium, so they can go to WYES.org. We have a whole list of other available documentaries, but they can find out more information about our program, and they can get
eventually
a copy themselves.
Purchase it.
Yeah, absolutely, for donations. So
they make
be great.
Such great gifts. They yes. really do. Well, Peg, you are a local treasure, and I want to thank you for coming to talk with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Bobby.
Peggy Scott Laborde and her new documentary, Nostalgic New Orleans Eats and Drinks. After the next short break, we'll take a streetcar ride with historian Michael Mizell Nelson, who examines the role streetcars played in the local food system of centuries past. We'll be right back. Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from French Market Coffee and Rouse's Markets. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's hero comes from a distinguished family of poor boy bread bakers with a tradition that dates back over 100 years. Recognizing that the iconic New Orleans poor boy sandwich was becoming endangered by an influx of national sandwich chains whose ad campaigns had begun to captivate the youth of today, he formed the New Orleans Poor Boy Preservation Society with the intent of protecting and preserving our famous New Orleans sandwich. In 2007, with help from the Idea Village, the Poor Boy Preservation Society began an annual festival in the Carrollton neighborhood on Oak Street. On the November Sunday the festival is held, over 7,000 poor boy loaves are delivered on site and filled with ingredients that range from fried lobster to bread pudding. But don't worry, the classic gravy-laden roast beef version is always available. I'll take mine dressed. That's why Sandy Wan of Leidenheimer's Bakery, creator of the Poor Boy Preservation Society, is this week's Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Hero, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. So if you're part of the party this weekend at the 6th Annual Poor Boy Festival, and you see the Leidenheimer's delivery guy trying to get those crispy long loaves through the crowd, pat him on the back and let him pass. Congratulations to you, Sandy Wan, and the whole Leidenheimer's crew for keeping our poor boy heritage alive. Because no matter which way you cut it, the poor boy sandwich is real Louisiana eat. Going to the Poor Boy Festival this weekend, you'll find the parking in the residential neighborhood of Carrollton can be a little tricky. Many people avoid the parking hassle and just hop on the St. Charles Avenue streetcar. We took a streetcar ride with Poor Boy historian Michael Mizell Nelson to learn all about the correlation between the streetcar and the Poor Boy sandwich.
The oldest continuously operating streetcar line in the world began traversing the streets of New Orleans in 1835. It's inevitable that in our food-obsessed city, many of those streetcar stories are culinarily related. University of New Orleans history professor Michael Mizell Nelson began his lifelong love of streetcars as a young boy. Riding back and forth to school, Michael struck up conversations with his fellow riders, many of them older than he. This is how he began to collect streetcar stories, which he later recorded in his documentary of the same name. Michael, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here, Poppy.
Most of us are familiar with the streetcar driver's strike that gave the Poor Boy sandwich its name. You are actually the one who did the definitive research on that.
Right. Well, there were a lot of stories about the streetcar strike, and I heard those. But there are other stories, too, about how the Poor Boy sandwich got its name. But I started to look into it just to try and see if I might find some evidence, and I stumbled across a letter from the Martin brothers, who had a coffee stand and restaurant in the French Market. And it was among many letters from businesses, coffee companies, furniture stores, people who were donating goods and services on behalf of the strikers in 1929. So this was one of the first things it told me it's pretty much definitive. But then I started to look at some of the menus, and I wanted to see when did the term po' boy or poor boy start to appear on the menus. And of course, old-time New Orleanians remember loaves. Sometimes you'll still see that on menus. Loaves for the French bread sandwiches. So you don't see that occurring until the early 1930s, so it is something that develops out of there. Now, it's the term poor boy and sandwich together. That's what happens after the strike.
Streetcars were commonly used for food delivery, so how did that work?
Well, it worked in a couple of ways. One, if somebody placed an order for groceries down the line, the grocer might come out, put a small box or bag of groceries, and offer a small tip, a cup of coffee or gum or cigarettes for the motorman and the conductor to stop at a certain point. There'd be someone waiting down the line. Pharmacists did the same thing if there was a special order and somebody needed some medicine right away. So it was sort of a delivery service that everyone might be able to use, and it was just part of the charm of the streetcar.
It's a long ride along the tracks from Carrollton to Claiborne all the way to Canal Street. So what was allowable for the conductors for bathroom or snack breaks?
Well, in the old days, it was the belt, the St. Charles belt. So you would go all the way around downtown, come back on two lane. And essentially, there was one official pit stop, and it was in Compagno's restaurant, so on Fern and St. Charles. And essentially what would happen is it's a kind of an ingenious little system, but it tells you just how life was meted out by the streetcars. Once the streetcar made a stop, the trolley pole that connects with the overhead wire would trip a device that would start the clock running. The conductor and motorman had 3 minutes to get off the car, go inside, use the restroom, order something to drink, order a sandwich. If it was a cold sandwich, cold cuts, they might place the order in a hurry, use the restroom, and on their way out, grab the sandwich and eat it on the streetcar. If it was a hot sandwich that they were ordering, they most likely, according to Sal Compagno, they would place the order and 56 to 57 minutes later when they made the round trip, it would be ready for them. And that, too, would be eaten on the streetcar.
Oh, that's a wonderful story. Was food ever sold on the streetcars?
It was in sort of strange circumstances. At the end of the magazine line, I have a wonderful story collected from a conductorette who spoke of people coming over from the Batchers, some of the squatters who lived close to Aubin Park, and they might carry catfish through the gills and board the streetcar briefly and try and make a sale. And in a sense, it's kind of like a mini or a micro market. At the end of the line, people coming home from work, you might have people who are trying to sell produce from their garden, catfish that have been caught in the river. So the most likely thing you'd see on the streetcar would be the newspaper boys who are allowed to board, ride for two blocks, get off, and then board again, the car going in the opposite direction. So you would see food that would be sold nearby, but you weren't supposed to eat on the streetcar.
Okay, no eating on the streetcar, but just caught almost wiggling catfish, okay. Was there any food that was banned on the streetcar?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite stories. I was interviewing Superintendent Janson, and Mr. Janson remembers that there was a regulation banning any sort of crawfish being brought onto the streetcar. You could bring crabs, you could bring, and then again, these could be live crabs caught out at West End if you're catching the West End car to go back to town. You could bring shrimp, but you are not allowed to bring crawfish. And I asked him about that, and his memory is that there was fear of some virus that caused the health department to say, no crawfish. And yet he remembers that you'd have all kinds of, you know, odors and water dripping from the baskets of crabs that were allowed on the car, but never any crawfish.
Now, the motorman had some special privileges when it came to transporting food, I think.
Yes, actually, one thing would happen, and this, again, is an example of how most of the streetcar barns, and there were, you know, five of them at one point during the height of street railways, you would live in the neighborhood, and if someone was working an evening shift, either his wife or sometimes his entire family or one of his children would bring some sort of hot meal and perhaps ride with their father going around the belt and get a chance to spend some time even while he was at work.
Well, that brings a whole new reality to the family dinner table. That is a charming thing. Any other animals?
Well, one of my favorite stories, too, is connected to the St. Claude line. And so, again, this would take people into St. Bernard Parish. And at times, some of the men would make deals with people who are raising cows and cattle. And in certain cases, if they had a big party, they might purchase a veal calf. And it would be living. They'd tie it up and they'd stick it under the longitudinal or beauty seats that people see at the very front, those long benches.
Oh, that's what the beauty seat is. It's the long bench. Okay.
Right, the long bench up at the front. And so they would actually take the calf back into the city, and they might take it to one of the neighborhood butchers and then, you know, essentially split the calf up. And so that's one of the more bizarre examples of food on the streetcar. Still a living, breathing calf, you know, sometimes making sounds under the beauty seat.
That's a wonderful story. Michael, thank you so much for sharing your streetcar food stories with us on Louisiana Eat.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Michael Mizell Nelson, professor of history and streetcar story specialist. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we get ready for Thanksgiving with roasting expert Molly Stevens.
I love to roast seafood, and I roast shrimp, I roast oysters, anything. It's similar to grilling in terms of the results you get. You can get these brown, caramelized exteriors and crispy end bits and tender inside. So I really encourage people, even if it's not kind of your tradition to roast it, it's sure a great way to prepare seafood.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from French Market Coffee, Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company, Lightsegan Funeral Homes, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to producer and sound engineer Thomas Walsh. Our editors, Zoe Sullivan and Lane Kaplan-Levinson. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.